I'm Lynn Sharon for Leonard Lopate. And I don't know about you, but the color I've been thinking about all week has been green, as in Earth Day, Earth Week. We've all been focused on our planet and what we can and should be doing to care for it, to save it. We know now what some scientists have been telling us for 30 or more years, that human activity on Earth is changing natural processes, especially climate. But how exactly do we measure those shifts? What are the methods and the means to determine the rate and the urgency of climate change? Well, here to explain today are NASA climate scientist Gavin Schmidt and photographer Joshua Wolf. They've edited a very beautiful book called Climate Change, Picturing the Science, which brings together scientific descriptions and photography to illustrate the processes and effects of climate change. It's published by Norton, and I'm very honored to be speaking with them today. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
The book is just fascinating because you have explained to me, in some cases for the first time, how the process actually works. So let's get right to it. Gavin, let me start with you, if I may. How many scientists and others around the globe are actually taking these measurements right now?
It's tens of thousands of scientists, and they're working on both measurements in the atmosphere, in the ocean, in ecosystems, and then back at the lab trying to work out what all of these different measurements are saying. People that are designing and running satellites that are in orbit over the Earth.
And is there one source of coordination for all this, or is everybody just operating on his or her own?
It's more like organized chaos rather than a it's not a Manhattan Project for climate change where everyone's sitting in the same buildings working desperately on this. Climate is one of those topics that brings together lots and lots of different expertises, people from the government research communities, people from the universities, people from all the different institutions across the world. It's something where, you know, everybody is pitching in and adding a little bit to the puzzle, and then when we bring it together, that's a coordinated affair.
Gotcha.
Where we're trying to bring all of that information, you know, what's important, what's not important, you know, what's the big picture here, and
well,
then
let's,
well,
let me,
what's going on.
Let me interrupt you and talk about pictures. Joshua, as a photographer, are you always looking for visible evidence of climate change to kind of bring it home to folks?
Well, we're looking for the visible signs, but I think the one great thing about this project is working with the scientists, we really went out of our way to find the signs that aren't always as visible and to find ways to show through images things that you wouldn't see if you just walked in the room, for example, using glacier before and after pictures.
Well, let's talk about a couple specifics that are in the book that I particularly like. There's one, perhaps, Joshua, you could, the Athabasca Glacier.
That was me, actually, so I can talk about that in detail.
We see that it has receded, obviously.
It has. It's receded dramatically, and when you're there, you're driving up a road.
And where are you exactly, Joshua, when you're there? I'm sorry to interrupt.
Oh, sorry. When you're there, you're driving up a road that used to be covered by the glacier. And they have pictures at the visitor center that dramatically show it was where you're standing now.
Right. So you're no longer on a glacier. You're standing on dry rock or on wet whatever, but it used to be solid ice. You also have a photograph in there of the Hoover Dam.
Yes. With that one, it's trying to show the various sources of energy. And people don't really think about where their energy comes from, how it's produced, and how it's transmitted. And the great thing about photography is to show how massive these projects are.
Well, you also make it clear that there's a what you guys refer to in your caption as a bathtub ring above where the actual water line is at the Hoover Dam.
That's Lake Powell, which is behind the Glen Canyon Dam.
Oh, Glen Canyon. So sorry.
And they've been in a persistent drought for many years now. And the projections for that reservoir indicate that it is very, very unlikely to fill up to the level that it was that you can see in that bathtub ring. There's both overuse of water in the Colorado Basin and historically low levels of precipitation rainfall, and so those two things are combining.
So there's visual evidence, and I made a little joke earlier. I said, you know, how do you measure climate change? How do you take the temperature of a planet? But in fact, you show photos of instruments bobbing in the sea, mounted in labs. Gavin Schmidt and photographer Joshua Wolf, your new book, Climate Change: Picturing the Science. Gavin, just tick down a list for me. Tell us some of the various instrumentations that are taking the readings that we need to know in order to map this.
Well, we've got satellites in orbit that are measuring the temperatures of the sea surface. We have weather stations across the planet that are there mainly for weather forecast purposes, but they're also providing a long-term record of climate change over the last 100 years. We've got the records of receding glaciers from every continent. We have changes in phenology, that's the flowering of particular plant species, the migration times of birds.
And these are all being measured now.
We're not measuring everything that we can possibly measure. We just don't have enough people to do that. But we're measuring as much as we can, and we're taking from that, and we're trying to extrapolate to the whole system.
Let's clarify something. We've been using the phrase climate change. It's the name of your book.
Mm-hmm.
What happened to global warming? Why the change in term?
Climate change is just the bigger... global warming is a subset of climate change. Climate change, you know, is something that encompasses changes in... the incidence of intense precipitation, changes in snow cover, changes in the sea ice. Some of those things are associated with global warming, but some of them, they're not the same thing. So it's not the point about climate change is that it's not just the temperature that's going to change. We'll see changes in wind patterns, we'll see changes in rainfall, we'll see changes in cloudiness and sea ice and all the other things that make up the Earth system.
I should point out that we are going to be delighted to take calls from our listeners. You can call in and ask Gavin and Joshua your questions about how climate change is measured. Call us here at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Gavin or Joshua, when did this all begin? When did scientists actually start taking these measurements, and how far back are the records reliable?
So people have been measuring temperature since the 16th century, but we've got a few long records that go back to maybe the 1700s from the observatory in Paris, in London, and a few other like point measurements. But that isn't really enough to give you a kind of global picture. So our estimates about global temperature go back maybe to, the kind of late 19th century, 1880s, something like that.
And we have
a reasonable idea.
How do you measure the temperature of the surface of the Earth?
Well, there are a number of features about the planet that make some of these things a little bit easier. And one of those things is that for instance, we're in New York, the monthly mean temperature anomaly here, you know, whether we're warmer or colder than the climatology. It turns out that if New York is like a degree warmer than it was normally, then Pittsburgh is going to be about a degree warmer, and in Chicago that will be warmer too. And so what you can have is a lot of connections between different places, but they're all kind of similar. And that means you have a really good chance of sampling that if you have a weather station in upstate New York and some in Pennsylvania and some in Illinois and some in Ohio. You can have a very good idea about what's going on because they're all giving you pretty much the same answer. So you have a lot of redundancy in the system, and that's what gives us the confidence that we're not fooling ourselves because somebody put their thermometer in a cup of tea or something.
And how do we measure the temperature of the ocean? Is it as simple as dropping a thermometer in the ocean?
Right now we have about 3,000 floating thermometers in the ocean scattered from the North Pole to the South Pole. And what they do is they go up and down in the water column. They float along with the currents, and every month or so they pop up to the surface, and then they radio back their information via satellite back to the data centers. And we're getting a very good picture of what the temperatures are doing in the ocean. And
before
that, we had to rely on ship measurements and the occasional scientific survey. So the further back in time you go, the data quality gets much worse.
And some of the most striking photographs in the book are of ice and ice measurements. When you go to photograph that, what are we looking for in those cases?
Well, I think you're looking for what we were trying to convey was, the people who are actually doing this, what they have to put up with in order to make the measurements, to measure the processes, to kind of understand, the physics of what happens when you form ice and when it melts and when icebergs calve. These are difficult measurements to make. You need to go to very remote places and work in very harsh conditions. And what we tried to do very strongly was convey, what it is that actual scientists do, and then how that information kind of gets synthesized into the kind of headlines that people see, the soundbite that you'll read on the evening news or something.
We're talking to Gavin Schmidt and Joshua Wolf, who've just done this very beautiful and fascinating new book, Climate Change: Picturing the Science, How Climate Change is Measured. And we're going to go to a caller now. We have a call from Mike in Newark, New Jersey. Mike, you're on the air.
Yeah, I have to say that this canard is brilliant. Global warming no longer fits the agenda, so we change it to climate change. And then any sort of bad weather can be attributed to man's evil pollution.
Okay, so I'm gathering, Mike, that your question is, do we really know this is caused by humans and not by natural conditions like the sun? Joshua, Gavin?
Well, actually, let me rephrase this question a little bit more clearly, I think. The issue is, can you attribute any random thing to climate change or to human activity? And the answer is no, of course you can't. Weather has all sorts of variability in it and has had since there was a climate system. And I often get called, when there's something odd or there's a big storm or there's a particularly warm day or a particularly cold day, somebody will call me up from one of the newspapers or TV stations and will say, oh, so is this global warming? And I'll say, no, that's just, the noise of weather. And people have very short memories about weather. They forget that last year there was something weird that happened and the year before there was something weird that happened. Climate change and what we're talking about in terms of global warming, these are issues that come out in the statistics. They come out in the long-term trends. They're not something that you can see, one day to the next. And there's a sense that, scientists like myself are going around saying everything is climate change. And that's just not true. And so, maybe I can reassure your caller that we're not claiming that every single thing that's happening on Earth is related to climate change.
Okay,
but
thank you.
Climate change is a real thing, and it is happening because of human activity.
We're going to go to another caller, a little bit more specific. This is from Dan in Manhattan. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question about the sea level and whether it has risen, actually, in the past few decades. And
yep.
Also, was the sea level higher during the peak of the last interglacial?
Okay, that's a great question. So we have tide records that go back a couple of hundred years. They show that sea level has been rising at about a millimeter or so a year, which doesn't seem very much, but it's been about 10 inches in the New York region over the last century. And we have better measurements now from satellites that have been tracking sea level on a more comprehensive basis in the last three decades, and they show that sea level is rising at about 3 millimeters per year now. Now, sea level rises because of two things. One is the change of the temperature of the ocean. As it gets warmer, the water expands, kind of filling up the bowl a little bit more. And then there's the term that comes from melting ice. So if you have ice on a mountain glacier or in an ice cap and it falls into the ocean, then that raises sea level. Our current estimates are that about half of the recent rise is related to the warming, and about half of the recent rise is related to melting glaciers, particularly on mountains, but also from Greenland and West Antarctica.
We are going to take more calls after the break, but for the moment, take down this number, 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692, and give us a call. I'm Lynn Scherr in for Leonard Lopate, and we are talking with Gavin Schmidt and Joshua Wolf, the writer and photographer, respectively, of a new book called Climate Change, Picturing the Science, How We Measure Climate Change. And this, of course, is this week's Please Explain. We would like to take your call, so give us a call, 212-433-9692, 212-433-9692. Gentlemen, let me start by asking you myself, does all of this measurement make a difference? Is this what has gotten us to where we are today, seeing the facts and figures, or have they come in after the fact?
Josh? Well, I think seeing the facts and figures, it's what helps us understand where we are and gives us a picture of where to go in the future. Obviously, the more data, the better, but it's really sort of figuring out where we go from now, I think, is the next step.
Does cataloging it, documenting it the way that you have with your photographs, with your essays, and I know you have contributions from others, from many scientists coming in on this, Gavin, is part of the effort here to make the world understand that this is scientific and not somebody's idea?
Yeah, kind of. One of the problems that we have is that people, you know, people are busy. They're getting on with their lives. They have lots of other concerns. And the information that they get about climate change or other environmental issues is very fleeting. You know, it's a headline here, it's a soundbite there, it's a joke on late-night TV. And there's a lot of people who know that that's not the whole story, that they know that this is a complicated subject and that, you know, the kind of soundbite journalism that they often come across, you know, is not the whole story. And what we wrote this book for was really to give people a guide to the complexities, to the whole story, and to show the people who are doing this so that, you know, they could have more of a connection to those people. I mean, it's not just something that's just being pushed from on high. It's not something that's just a hobby horse of an environmental organization. It is something that's coming from the totality of the scientific community, and it's coming from people who are measuring things as diverse as pine bark beetle spread in Alaska to corals in the Pacific to penguin colonies in Antarctica.
Indeed.
And they're all coming up with something that's a consistent picture of climate change over the last few decades.
And that's what we are trying to explain in Please Explain, which is how in the world do you measure the world? Let's go to another caller. This is Oscar from Weehawken, New Jersey. Hi, Oscar. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. My question has to do with droughts. Waterfall, right? It gets evaporated mostly from the oceans, and then mm-hmm. it's got to go somewhere. It's got to rain. And we see all these places that have droughts. Are there any places that are inundated, any places that are completely flooded?
well, floods and droughts are sometimes two sides of the same coin. When we look at how things have changed over the last few decades and how we think they're going to change in the future, one of the things that we expect is that the high latitudes, kind of from New York on north, we expect it to rain more, and we expect it to rain more and in more intense bursts. Now, that is one factor that leads to greater flooding because you have more water in a shorter time. But flooding is also a human management issue because a lot of rivers are controlled and a lot of people have built in rather inappropriate places. And so the severity of floods, there's a climate component, but there's also a human infrastructure component. And it turns out that is really the big story that comes out of our book, is that it's not just climate change that's changing and that's the bad thing. It's the intersection of climate change with human infrastructure. Mm. Now, when it comes to increasing droughts, there are parts of the world where we expect arid regions to expand because of changes in the circulation of the atmosphere. So that kind of spreads from like the American Southwest possibly to Amazonia, to Africa, and to parts of India and Asia. And there are reasonable ways, well, there are reasonable theories to explain why that would be the case. But there's still a fair bit of uncertainty about exactly how that will work out in any one particular location.
Gavin Schmidt answering the question from Oscar. Thank you so much, Oscar. We're going to go to, as long as we're doing water, I got another one on water and oceans from Frank in Yonkers. Hi, Frank. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. I know this is simplistic, but I really don't understand it. If I have a glass of water and there's a whole lot of ice in it, even rising up higher than the mm-hmm. surface of the water, when the ice cubes melt, the water does not overflow the glass.
That's right. So what we're talking about when we're talking about melting ice affecting sea level, we're not talking about the ice that's already floating in the sea. What we're talking about is the ice that's on land. So if you go to Greenland, for instance, the ice cap there is about 3,000 meters thick, and parts of that are falling into the sea. As they fall into the sea, that does raise the sea level. So it's like you're adding extra ice cubes into your glass, and I assure you that does cause it to spill over.
Oh, great question, Frank. Thanks very much, and thanks for the answer. So let me ask a question now about greenhouse gases. Two-part question for you, Gavin. How do we measure greenhouse gases, and will the EPA ruling affect measurement or just affect how we deal with it?
So we measure greenhouse gases in a number of ways. For some of the gases that stick around for a long time, they get well mixed in the atmosphere. It's like you've got a cup of tea and you've stirred it so that the milk is evenly spread throughout the whole cup. And that's the case for gases like carbon dioxide, for instance. So we can go to a remote location far away from, you know, any potential sources of local pollution, and we can measure the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere there. And one of the classic places where we do this is on the top of Mauna Loa in Hawaii, but we also do it at the South Pole. We also do it, you know, at a lot of different locations around the world, and you get pretty much the same number wherever you measure it. And that number has been increasing, has increased about 38% since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, and is increasing by about the average number now is about 380 parts per million for carbon dioxide, and that's increasing by about 2 parts per million every year.
Okay, let's go to another gas question, actually. We have a caller from New Jersey. Jay in New Jersey, you're on the air.
Hi. I just want to talk about the methane gas released by the livestock industry.
Uh-huh.
And as the population grows more, the gases are going to, you know, rising up too.
That's true.
How are you going to deal with that?
Okay, so this raises a very important point, which is that climate change is not being driven solely by changes in carbon dioxide. Methane gas, which is also a greenhouse gas, has more than doubled in industrial times. And the sources from that, as the caller rightly said, come from the increasing numbers of farm animals, the increasing amount of effluent from agriculture, the increasing amount of landfills and irrigated land. Methane comes about when you have a very wet, organic decay, either in very, very wet conditions or in conditions where there's not enough air for the bacteria, for other kinds of bacteria to live.
So methane gas is adding to that. Let me go to
let me kind of just answer his question. So how do you deal with that? That's very difficult. So people are looking to make changes to the feedstock for cows and sheep, particularly, so that you can kind of try and control their gas via additives to their feed. People are trying to capture methane from the landfills. They're trying to be more careful about the irrigation so that they don't inundate such large areas of land. And they're trying to capture methane from, from effluent piles and things. And you can use that methane to power turbines and to create electricity. So those are win-win situations when it comes to controlling methane that a lot of people are trying to adopt now.
Thank you for your call, and thank you for the answer. You know, we're talking about measuring all of these things like gases and mm-hmm. water and temperature. What other signs are being used to give us clues about the urgency and the level of global warming or climate change? Changes in insects, for example, any changes in animal
right.
life? Is that a part of the picture as well?
Absolutely. Yeah, so changes to the onset of spring, when Virginia bluebells bloom, or when the cherry blossoms bloom. We have records of those in China, in Japan. They have records of cherry blossoms that go back, you know, almost 1,000 years. And we can do the same thing here. There's a new project called the United States Phenology Project, which is trying to coordinate citizen scientists everywhere around the country to write in with their observations about, you know, when they first see a particular kind of bird that's migrating, or when they first see the trees budding or the flowers blooming. And those kinds of databases are an essential part of like just being a check on everything else that we're doing. And the changes that we're seeing are completely consistent with what the instrumental record has been telling us. But let me throw in one other thing. You know, scientists are, you know, we're always looking for, you know, interesting ways to find out what's going on. And there are cases, and we talk about one in the book, where through accidental releases of, for instance, there was a container ship that lost a container in the middle of the Pacific, and it contained lots of floating bath toys, plastic ducks, plastic turtles, and I think a plastic beaver. And these toys just floated around in the Pacific, and then they started being picked up on beaches in Alaska. And those the return times for those plastic ducks and where they got to have been telling us about the currents in the Pacific. They've been telling us about the transit time of water from the Pacific all the way to the Atlantic. These ducks have been found in Maine and in Scotland. And you know, we're always looking for neat ways to find out what's going on about in the world.
And there's a wonderful photograph of a couple of those little rubber duckies in
That's
the
right.
book that sort of it's interesting. How it drives home, Gavin Schmidt and Joshua Wolfe, the photographer, have driven home the idea that so much of what we're doing for these measurements is it's either very, very sophisticated or it's kind of right around the corner. The idea that an accidental loss of some rubber ducks, some toys, could make you understand currents is wonderfully fascinating.
Well, kind of, we're willing to take anything that we can get.
Whatever there is, exactly.
It's so complex and it's so under-sampled.
Let's go to another call. I think this is a real New York question. This is Tim here in New York in Tribeca. Go ahead, Tim. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I just want to mention first how lucky we are, actually, that we're facing global warming and not global cooling. You know, we've been lulled into a false sense of security by the last 500 years of relative stability. But climate change is really the norm. You know, we have to consider what's a sustainable population for this planet, given the normal fluctuations in temperature. A lot of the problems with global warming are really problems with overpopulation, and maybe we should be spending more effort at that. But that said, how much of the recorded temperature increase is due to the fact that those temperatures are taken in cities and towns and the result of local human effect, not global human effect?
So that's a great question. So if you live in New York, you will have noticed that the temperatures in the metro area are often a few degrees warmer than they are once you get out to the countryside. And even actually going into Central Park, you can notice a slight cooling from the city streets to the park areas. So scientists are well aware of this kind of effect, and we spend a lot of time trying to eliminate those effects from the records, and we think we've done a reasonable job. We particularly like looking at weather stations that are in rural areas rather than in cities, and we kind of try and correct for that. And then we look for, you know, ancillary measurements that aren't affected by that. So temperature changes in the ocean aren't affected by the cities on the shore. And so when we have, matches of temperature that change in the ocean to what we're seeing on the land, then we can have some confidence that we've been able to eliminate those effects.
Let me switch topics here very slightly. Yesterday, I moderated a panel, annual environmental lunch at the American Museum of Natural History here in New York. And one of the panelists was Gus Speth, who was, of course, the dean of the School of Forestry at Yale, he's one of the great environmentalists of all times. He's been working on this subject for more than 30 years. One of the things he points to is what he calls affluenza. We just own too much stuff, and that's contributing to the problem. Joshua Wolfe, as the guy who took the pictures and arranged all the pictures in this book, what do you say about all the stuff out there? Do you see any evidence of that making a difference?
Well, when you're dealing with something like climate change, as Gavin said earlier when talking about every record is valuable. It's every piece of the puzzle. Earlier caller alluded to population. Gus has been talking about the amount of stuff people are buying, is this whole picture of everything we're doing on the planet adds up and has an effect. And so it's the consumption, it's the population, it's the resource use. And when you're going out and photographing it, you really do see all this development, all this population, and how it's changing things.
One of the things that we would like to know as well is the consequences of wind farms. I know you shot some turbines or have some pictures of turbines in here. Josh, you've talked about it, Gavin. What happens when you start wind farms and then a lot of them are up and going and you've essentially removed energy from the atmosphere? Is that a problem potentially?
That people have started to think about that. And if we went to 100% wind, then the estimates are that you would slow down the atmosphere a tad, but it's not, you know, in terms of the impact on the environment per kilowatt, it's a really small effect. It's something that, you know, it's kind of academic interest, but not really a practical problem.
Oh, good. Something not to worry about. I like right. to cross things off my list.
Yeah, no, I'd be happy to help you out with that.
Okay.
The other thing with wind is the grid issue. You know, it's not enough to just have, you know, put up windmills and turbines in windy areas. You need to have the grid infrastructure to take that energy and take it to where people need it,
and be able.
And that's where we've the infrastructure really isn't there just yet. So that's one of the places where we need to do some more.
Have to know how to use it. We're going to go to another. I must say, I think the questions from our listeners are wonderful. People are very well informed on this subject, no doubt. By all the reporting that's been done, it will be enhanced by your new book, Climate Change. Gavin Schmidt and Joshua Wolf. Let's go to another caller from here in Manhattan. This is Mario. Hi, Mario. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hi. Can you describe how much energy is represented by a 1 degree rise in global average temperature?
Well, that's not really. That's an odd question. The amount of let me put it another way then. The amount of extra energy that's coming into the system because of the changes in greenhouse gases, particularly carbon dioxide, is equivalent to about 1.6 watts for every meter squared of the Earth's surface. Now, you can visualize that by, you know, like one little Christmas tree bulb is 1 watt, and then you have one of those in every kind of square that's, you know, like 3 feet by 3 feet. But it's on every square on the surface of the planet, and it's on, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. And that's a measure of how much extra energy we're kind of keeping in the Earth system as opposed to letting it go out to space because of the changes that we've made in greenhouse gases. And that, so far, has led to a temperature change of around maybe a little over 1 degree Fahrenheit. But the planet is still catching up with what we're doing. The planet has a thermal inertia. It takes a while to warm up, if you like. And the planet hasn't really come into equilibrium with what we've already done. And so we can expect things to warm up from that. And because we're not just keeping everything steady, we're actually making the problem worse year on year, we can expect that the temperatures will continue to rise, you know, for a good few decades.
Gavin Schmidt, thank you so much. We have lots more questions we're never going to get to, but you can get some of the answers in Gavin Schmidt and Joshua Wolf's new book, Climate Change, Picturing the Science. And I hope that on this week's edition of Please Explain, you've understood at least a tiny bit better about how we measure climate change. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Lynn Scherr, sitting in for Leonard Lopate on WNYC and WNYC.org.